Ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages, gather around the radio. It's time now for another installment of A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups. My name is Michael Harris, and it's my privilege to serve as anchor of the program. It's an ensemble show, lots of good people involved, and its host and founder is Carol Marks. Carol Marks is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues, and she's a champion in the battle against ageism. On today's program, she'll be talking with four very learned and interesting individuals. It's a great program. We'll be talking about human intelligence and how it operates. We'll be talking about medical marijuana. We'll be talking about colorectal cancer. And we're going to kick it off right now with a discussion about the importance of the Supreme Court looking back in history. And what happened in 1927, a book written by Adam Cohen titled Imbeciles, the Supreme Court, American Eugenics, and the Sterilization of Carrie Buck, published by Penguin.
Now, I never realized that the United States in the 1920s was so caught up in the frenzy that promoted eugenics or the use of selective breeding. So who were some of our leading citizens and some of our leading universities that really went all out to promote it? Surprise.
Yeah, it is amazing. It became a national craze, and you know that was at the grassroots level, magazines and best-selling books. But as you say, some of our leading citizens, people like the president of Harvard University, the president of Stanford, John D. Rockefeller, Alexander Graham Bell, and even Theodore Roosevelt, who, you know, we admire for so many reasons. These people were all eugenicists, and then, of course, as you alluded to, the Supreme Court was too.
And now you write in your book that ineffective marriage laws, segregation, anti-Semitism, and the expensive warehousing of those who were considered feeble-minded also played a role in those advocating using mass involuntary sterilization as a solution to prevent future generations from producing feeble-minded people. So is it fair, though, to say that at that time, the common belief of many of those supporting eugenics was that they were actually using science to make the world a better place?
Absolutely. So, you know, a lot of this started with Charles Darwin and the discovery of evolution and the survival of the fittest. So that was what nature was doing. But the eugenicists thought, well, we can speed that process along and make sure that the fittest people survive if we choose who should reproduce more and then who shouldn't be allowed to reproduce at all. So they thought they were using these, you know, evolutionary and genetic advances to uplift humanity, and they did it through passing laws that were designed to take these genetic ideas into action and say which genes we wanted more of in the next generation and which genes we didn't want at all.
And I understand that part of the false science that the eugenics used to justify their cause came from a study in a book about a family, the Jukes, who generation after generation produced criminals and prostitutes. And then they used that to say that bad traits were the results of heredity and not that environment. And didn't that lead to individual states starting to really issue these laws to prevent what they call the unfit from reproducing?
Yes, exactly. You know, there was a craze in academia at the time of doing these studies, just like the one you mentioned about the Jukes, where they would send out researchers to, you know, generally, you know, poor rural areas, and they would study the people and find out, you know, if they seem to be unintelligent or seem to have, you know, delinquency or prostitution in their families. And they would write these, you know, really very biased and derogatory academic studies saying that this was all a product of bad genes and not, you know, as you say, environment, where a lot of people were living in poverty and there was very little education, and it wasn't anything genetic at all. It's that we just hadn't really given people a chance in life. But there were a lot of studies like this Jukes study that purported to say that whole families, whole communities were, you know, genetically unfit and were bringing down the country.
Now, let's get to talk about the 1927 Supreme Court case, Buck versus Bell, in one of its darkest moments, because the court allowed the state of Virginia to sterilize Carrie Buck, even though she was a perfectly normal young woman. So at the heart of your book, there are five people who really played pivotal roles in this tragically misguided Supreme Court case. So can you tell us a little bit about Carrie Buck and how she, in a way, was at the wrong place at the wrong time?
Yes, absolutely. So Carrie Buck was this, you know, poor young woman who had been born to a poor family in Charlottesville, Virginia, a white woman, raised by a single mother, taken in by a foster family that actually was not very nice to her at all. They wouldn't let her call them mother and father. They put her to work doing housework in their house and other people's houses. They pulled her out of school after fifth grade, although she was doing perfectly fine. And then one summer she was actually raped by the nephew of the foster mother. So she's pregnant out of wedlock, and rather than try to help her through this, you know, horrible trauma ordeal, they decide to get her declared epileptic and feeble-minded and sent off to this colony for epileptics and feeble-minded in Virginia outside of Lynchburg. So she is declared to be epileptic and feeble-minded, even though she was not epileptic. She had never had a seizure in her life, just wasn't epileptic, and wasn't feeble-minded. She had been doing perfectly fine in school. She gets to the colony for epileptics and feeble-minded right after Virginia has passed one of these eugenic sterilization laws, and she gets chosen by the, you know, one of the villains of the book, Dr. Albert Pretty, the guy who ran the colony, to be the first person in Virginia sterilized under the new law, and they give her a lawyer and let her challenge the sterilization order.
And in response to the Supreme Court, the Justice, Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr., wrote about the case, this very well-known statement, to justify what they were doing. Three generations of imbeciles are enough. So what made you write that there were not three generations of imbeciles, perhaps not even one?
Right. So the thing is, Carrie Buck was not feeble-minded, as I mentioned. She had done well in school, and they just, you know, gave her a test at the colony, one of these, you know, really badly created IQ tests, which purported to show she was feeble-minded. Her mother was also an inmate at the colony, but, you know, it probably was also sent there because she was poor and living on the streets and not really because she was feeble-minded. I don't believe the testing that they gave her. And then they did a crazy thing with her baby, the one that was the product of her rape. This was an infant at the time, and they sent an expert to examine the baby, and the baby was compared to another baby in the household that was around the same age, and this expert said he could tell by this baby's, you know, reactions and the way it moved and so forth that it was feeble-minded too, that she was feeble-minded. And that just isn't true. That child was not feeble-minded. So none of them were feeble-minded. None of them were imbeciles, but the court nevertheless said that they were.
Now, in the Supreme Court case, did anyone stand up for Carrie Buck? What about her lawyer?
Yeah, so, you know, the fix was in from the beginning. They gave her a lawyer who had been the chairman of the board of directors of the colony for epileptics and feeble-minded. So her lawyer was actually not on her side, and he wrote, you know, pretty bad briefs that didn't raise some of the best legal arguments. And back in those days, there really weren't, you know, the kind of public interest organizations we have now looking out for the rights of the developmentally disabled or the rights of inmates or anything like that. So there was really no one on her side. So Carrie Buck goes up, you know, uneducated because they didn't let her keep going in school, with a lawyer who's not on her side, and everyone else is ganging up on her to sterilize her, to do this terrible operation that will prevent her from having children, cutting into her, the government doing this, and everyone was on that side, and that's just what happened.
And another important character in your book is Dr. Harry Laughlin, a former Missouri agriculture professor and turned out to be a Nazi sympathizer, and he actually, it's hard to believe, but he thought that 15 million Americans should be sterilized, and I was really surprised to learn about the important role he played in getting the 1924 immigration law passed in Congress, and we're still fighting about that, aren't we, these days, and was the law back then put into place because they didn't want to have certain groups of people come to the United States because they thought they were inferior?
It absolutely was. So, you know, this Harry Laughlin, who you mentioned, who is one of the villains of the book, was actually appointed by the U.S. House of Representatives Committee on Immigration to be what was called the expert eugenics agent for Congress. And I actually saw the letterhead in his papers in Missouri that said he's, you know, a congressional letterhead, expert eugenics agent. He testified to Congress that certain nationalities were genetically less fit than others, and they passed this 1924 Act, which put quotas on certain countries, how many people they could send to the United States. So in the old days, it was, you know, almost just show up at Ellis Island and you can get in. This law, you know, limited the number of people who could come from Eastern Europe, from Italy, from places like that, because the Congress was, you know, told that these people were inferior. And it ended up being, you know, particularly bad for people who were trying to flee Nazi Germany, a lot of the Jews and others who were trying to flee because they ran up against these quotas. And they were put in place for eugenic reasons. So as I say in the book, you know, with Anne Frank, we learned that Anne Frank died in a concentration camp because the Nazis thought that she was genetically inferior as a Jew. But to some extent, she also died in a concentration camp because the U.S. Congress did, because her father actually was writing to the State Department trying to get visas for the whole family and was turned down repeatedly, and that's because of this 1924 law. So it was a terrible law that, you know, really hurt many, many people, and it was done in large part for eugenic reasons.
That's Adam Cohen, author of Imbeciles, The Supreme Court, American Eugenics and the Sterilization of Carrie Buck, published by Penguin. The interview is conducted by the host of our program, Carol Marks, and it's an excerpt from a larger conversation that you can listen to on our website at www.atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E. Carol Marks in conversation with Philip Fernback, a cognitive scientist and professor of marketing at the University of Colorado's Leeds School of Business. That's next, when A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues in a moment.
Going back to my Vegas thing, you cost me a lot of misery, and all total, $2,700 in doggy fees, and all it took was one container of Dynavite, 2 pounds, 3 ounces, and my dog has been cured. Abby's a 5-year-old silky terrier. She had, like, chicken pox on her belly, clusters of bumps on her back, and she was allergic to, like, 70-some-odd things. So the dermatologist, it was, oh, yeah, just keep giving her needles every 10 days, but she's not clearing up. And then it came up on my radio, Dynavite.
Dinovite.
.com 859-428-1000.
Dynavite is nutrition.
I give her the Dynavite after 5 weeks, and one morning there was nothing there, and I'm like, she's all clear. There wasn't one blemish on her body. Her fur is beautiful. She is totally happy. She is as healthy, bump-free, pimple-free, shiny, silky. It turned our lives around. So thank you very much for Dynavite. I couldn't be happier. Dynavite's the bomb.
859-428-1000.
859-428-1000.
Dinovite.com.
Bernadette Duncan spent 26 years as a radio talk show producer. In her new book, Yappy Days, Behind the Scenes with Newsers, Schmoozers, Boozers, and Losers, she shares her adventures in the trenches of big-time talk radio during the changing backdrop of America's pre- and post-9/11 realities. This exciting story includes Bernadette's impressions of the quirky celebrity talk show hosts whom she served during her career, Larry King, Sally Jesse Raphael, Gil Gross, Tom Snyder, Lou Dobbs, Charles Osgood, and more. It's full of anecdotes about hundreds of high-profile guests from media, show business, and politics. Also quirky, ego-driven, and neurotic. Yappy Days, Behind the Scenes with Newsers, Schmoozers, Boozers, and Losers. An analytical look at the media, journalism, and the complex nature of ego. Get it now at Amazon.com. Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair. And here again is our host, Carol Marks, in conversation now with Philip Fernback, a cognitive scientist and professor of marketing at the University of Colorado's Leeds School of Business. He lives in Boulder, Colorado, and he's co-written a book, The Knowledge Illusion, Why We Never Think Alone, published by Riverhead Books. Psychology Today refers to this book as a breezy guide to the mechanisms of human intelligence.
Cognitive science is the study of the mind, and it's a very interdisciplinary field. The mind and the brain are the most complex objects in the known universe, so it takes a lot of different fields to really understand them. So you have people from psychology, from computer science, from philosophy, from neuroscience, from linguistics, and many other fields, all sort of working together to try to understand how the mind works, how the brain processes information. And what I do is I'm a cognitive psychologist. I study high-level cognition, which means I look at how people think and make decisions. The roots of cognitive science have been around for a long time, but really got going in the 1950s during what was called the cognitive revolution, where a lot of great thinkers started to understand how computers work. And that really got people thinking that the brain might be a kind of computer.
And I found your book so fascinating and eye-opening, Philip, because I love to learn about new things, what makes us unique as human beings, the way our mind works. And I always thought my mind must be on overflow with all the knowledge stored there. So what made you endorse what one writer said, that our mind is like a garbage heap? And can you go on to give our listeners some examples? Because that's kind of amazing, a garbage heap.
Yeah, actually, so the reason, the point of that was actually to say exactly the opposite, that our minds are not like a garbage heap. So that quote comes from a story, which is a wonderful short story by Borges, which is called Funes the Memorius, and it tells the story of a guy who remembers every last thing that occurs, that happens to him. And actually, there are human beings who actually have something similar. It's called hyperthymesia. And what that means is you remember everything, and you might think, oh, this is great, this is like a superpower, but in fact it's not so great, because if you remember everything, it's really, really hard to pick out what's important to help you to decide how to act in a new situation.
And that's what is important. And what your book points out so effectively, that most of the knowledge we need to learn about our how to function effectively and understand what's going on in our world comes not from our brain, but from other people's brains. And so that goes into a little bit about the fact that today we are bombarded with fake news, and we don't know whether the news that we're hearing is truthful or not. But it's not a new story, because fabricated stories were used even by some of America's most revered founding fathers. And I was amazed to find out what Ben Franklin did when he was American ambassador in Paris. I thought it was kind of horrible.
I think it's a fantastic point you're making, which is a lot of the times when we look at what's going on now, we say, oh my gosh, human beings must be getting so much dumber and so much more gullible and so on. But actually, all the evidence that I know of suggests that that's not the case. And that's really one of the major points of our book, is that these kind of things are driven by fundamental aspects of the way the mind works. And in this case, our book is really about how we overestimate how well we understand things as individuals. Individuals don't store a lot of detailed information in their minds. And the reason that we're able to get by despite this is because that we're very good at drawing on our community of knowledge. So the knowledge is really shared across the community. And so individuals themselves don't know very much, and that makes them very susceptible to believing things that aren't true if they come down from people that they trust. And I think it's really a mistake to treat what's going on now as something that's dramatically new. I mean, if you look back in history, you see a lot of the same kind of patterns. It's maybe more surprising that it happens now, because we all think of ourselves as being so educated and informed and technology savvy and so on compared to yesteryear. But really, the fundamental attributes of the way the mind work have not changed, and therefore we always have these repeated kind of situations.
And has research lately can tell us about the fact that our intelligence is not just the sole property of an individual, but it is a result of a team?
I think, yes, that's a great point as well. We have a chapter in the book where we talk about what we call the new definition of intelligence. And we think it's a little misguided the extent to which intelligence testing and assessment really focuses for the most part on individual mental horsepower, the ability to store a lot of information, the ability to do things really quickly, to maybe do mathematical computations in your head quickly. We think that stuff has been kind of overplayed because everything we do as human beings that's worth doing, we do in teams. And so really what we should be thinking about is an important aspect of intelligence is really contributing to a team's performance in terms of achieving complex goals.
And what I found really most amazing about of the things that you talk about in your book is when you say that we don't even realize we're absorbing all this helpful information that's coming in from outside.
Yeah, so we talk in the book about this idea of contagious understanding, where we often feel like we understand just by virtue of the fact that others around us feel like they understand. And so I think that that's a really pervasive issue. We might not have the details, but because the knowledge is distributed across our community and we can access it if we want, we kind of feel like we ourselves have the information already in our heads. And that can lead people to overestimate how well they understand things.
Now, if you had to say, what new insights do you hope your readers and our listeners will take away after they have read your book? And can these insights really lead us to having a more enlightened society and government?
I would hope so. I mean, I think one of the starting points of the book is that we should not be embarrassed about the fact that we don't understand the world in all its complexity. The world is just way too complex for any one individual to understand. And the mind just isn't made for storing huge amounts of information. It's made for other kinds of things. And so if we put the focus there and we are a little more humble about how much we actually understand, I think it can lead to definitely a more productive kind of productive discussions. If we feel like we understand everything, even when we don't, we end up arguing about stuff where neither side really has the goods to support their position. So that's a major insight, I think, of readers of the book. Another piece is if some of your listeners are interested in psychology, have maybe read some other books about human decision-making or human thinking, what I think our book does is it provides a different perspective on the way the mind works than they might be familiar with. And so really, me and my co-author Steve are cognitive scientists. We're interested in how the mind works. And so a good portion of the book is really diving into the science of how the mind processes information and how we collaborate with others sort of cognitively to solve problems.
Well, Philip, everybody that is in the legislature in Congress, both the House and the Senate, they all should get a copy of your book because you read about how important teamwork would be having people from both sides of the aisle get together and work as a team and actually get things done.
Totally agree with you.
That's Philip Fernbeck, author of The Knowledge Illusion, Why We Never Think Alone, published by Riverhead Books. The interview is conducted by the host of our show, Carol Marks. Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues in a moment. Hi, this is Michael Harrison. I hope you're enjoying this installment of A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, and finding it to be a meaningful listening experience. This wonderful little weekend program has been on the radio across America in one form or another for more than 20 years. Its mission is to provide mature Americans with information and content about aging to help them cope with the nonstop challenges of life during these hectic modern times. We're talking about health, finances, relationships, and plain old fun. Whether it's learning about the latest technology and social norms, or fondly remembering yesterday's arts and entertainment, A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, is dedicated to serving that gigantic segment of the population so sadly ignored by most of today's popular media. Founded and hosted by a truly great lady, Carol Marks, one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the ongoing battle against ageism, this program is geared to what has commonly been referred to as the sandwich generation. baby boomers who are coping with such challenges as still supporting their adult children while caring for their elderly parents. It's my honor and privilege to be associated with Carol Marx and be a part of her mission to support, defend, and inspire today's generation of what she lovingly calls seasoned citizens. A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, online at www.atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E. And right here on this great radio station every weekend. Thank you so much for listening.
This is Brad Shepard. Whenever you think of Social Security, do you think of survivor's benefits too? You see, Social Security is more than retirement. Social Security makes regular monthly payments to the families of workers who die too. More than 7 million people get survivor's benefits from Social Security, including almost 2 million children. Benefits that pay for food and clothing, medical care, and school benefits you can count on when you're planning your financial future. For more information, go to the SSA website at www.ssa.gov.
Michael Harrison here. Those of you who follow talk radio and are interested in what goes on behind the scenes might also know me as the publisher of Talkers Magazine, the trade publication that serves the talk media industry. We cover the talk show business as it exists on radio, television, and the internet. I often have the opportunity to speak about these media as a guest on radio and TV talk shows or comment on industry developments in newspapers and magazines. For the past year and a half, I've also hosted a weekly podcast that delves into the media in general and focuses on the rapid changes, not only in radio, but all of communications technology. Changes that I believe are contributing to rewiring the human nervous system. Computers, social media, and all the different platforms of instantaneous communications that define the new digital age are combining to actually accelerate our evolution as a species. Sound pretty far out? Well, it is. As a matter of fact, the name of this podcast series is Up Close and Far Out with Michael Harrison. Each week, I interview an outstanding personality from the world of radio or any number of its related fields in the arts, sciences, entertainment, politics, or academia. It's available to download, and you can subscribe to it at absolutely no charge whatsoever at iTunes or at the website www.upcloseandfarout.com. Up Close and Far Out with Michael Harrison. Just a click away on your computer or mobile device. Visit iTunes or www.upcloseandfarout.com. Make Up Close and Far Out with Michael Harrison a weekly podcast listening experience. Thank you. This week on Up Close and Far Out with Michael Harrison, our guest is a leading broadcast executive, Norm Pattis.
Going back to my Vegas thing, you cost me a lot of misery, and all total, $2,700 in doggy fees, and all it took was one container of Dynavite, 2 pounds, 3 ounces, and my dog has been cured. Abby's a 5-year-old silky terrier. She had, like, chicken pox on her belly, clusters of bumps on her back, and she was allergic to, like, 70-some-odd things. So the dermatologist, it was, oh, yeah, just keep giving her needles every 10 days, but she's not clearing up. And then it came up on my radio, Dynavite.
Dinovite. .com.
859-428-1000.
Dynavite is nutrition.
I give her the Dynavite after 5 weeks, and one morning there was nothing there, and I'm like, she's all clear. There wasn't one blemish on her body. Her fur is beautiful. She is totally happy. She is as healthy, bump-free, pimple-free, shiny, silky. It turned our lives around. So thank you very much for Dynavite. I couldn't be happier. Dynavite's the bomb.
859-428-1000. 859-428-1000.
Dinovite.com.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and here again is the host of our program, Carol Marx, in conversation with David Behrman, M.D., one of the most clinically knowledgeable physicians in the U.S. in the field of medical marijuana.
Well, marijuana really is a pejorative term that was chosen for propaganda purposes. It was a term that was popularized by William Randolph Hearst, who was a newspaper mogul, very rich. His father was a silver baron. And Hearst is probably most famous, in addition to having this very lavish lifestyle, for stirring up emotions around the Spanish-American War at the end of the 19th century. But he continued to have hostility towards Hispanics. And when you had the Mexican Revolution in 1910, it brought a lot of poor Mexicans into this country to avoid the mayhem of the revolution, and they bought cannabis with them, and they called it marijuana. And most Americans at that time were very familiar with cannabis and hemp, but to them, marijuana was a foreign term. And so it was introduced basically to create confusion, and it was very successful at doing that. Cannabis and hemp are really cousins. Hemp is kind of a tall plant without too many leaves on it, and cannabis is a short, bushy plant. Hemp, pretty much by law, needs to have less than 0.3% of THC, and if it has more than 0.3% of THC, then it's cannabis. And the amount of THC that the government, which can legally grow cannabis and has an acre or so devoted to it down at the University of Mississippi, their cannabis has about 4% THC. And the average recreational cannabis that's sold in this country has 8 or 9%, and it's certainly not uncommon to find 15 or 16%.
What really, you know, caught my attention and that you pointed out so well was the ironic fact that American production of hemp was actually mandated by our government in the 17th century for the purpose of making rope and sails and clothing. And then in the late 19th century, marijuana became a popular ingredient in many medicinal products and was sold openly in public pharmacies. Any comments? And wasn't cannabis really recognized thousands of years ago for its useful medical properties? So it seems like, in a way, the United States has had kind of a hypocritical history when it comes to cannabis, or now what we call marijuana.
Exactly. What happened was that cannabis for 1,000 years, or hemp, for 1,000 years was the most successful agricultural plant in the world. And it fell off in the late 19th century because of the rise of steam sailing rather than sailing vessels that needed canvas and rigging and that sort of thing. In fact, if you think about this, hemp was really the oil of the 16th, 17th, 18th, and early 19th century. And that's why it was so important. British had the largest navy in the world, and hemp was really one of the main reasons for settling the United States, because Great Britain wanted that hemp to make canvas and to make rigging for their boats. The USS Constitution, for instance, required 200 tons of hemp in order to make the sails and the rigging that was necessary for that.
One of the important businesses, and I was surprised about this, was the DuPont family business that I think helped a lot in getting the Marijuana Tax Act passed in 1937. So were there other businesses like DuPont that really thought it was in their interest to shut down cannabis being produced and accepted in this country?
Yes. What happened was that in 1916, a man named Schlichten got a patent for a decorticator, a harvesting device that cut the labor in half necessary to harvest and prepare hemp for industrial use. And he actually caught the attention of Timken, of the Timken Roller Bearing Company, and they got the attention of Scripps and had him interested in using cannabis for newsprint. Now, Hearst at the time had about 80,000 acres of wood pulp, so he had an interest in discouraging that. We don't know whether it was Hearst or whether it was other people who had wood pulp, but while Scripps had an initial interest in making newsprint out of hemp, which would have been about half the price in 1917, He suddenly lost interest, and Schlichten dies in 1924. So in 1933, his patent runs out. And, by the way, his decorticator had caught the attention of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. So in 1916, they issued Bulletin 404 to the farmers of America saying, hey, hemp is going to make a comeback. Well, in 1933, you now have other industrialists who are looking at the decorticator. The patent has run out, and they're tinkering around with improving that. And there's a lot of indirect or circumstantial evidence that DuPont was concerned about a competition from hemp. And why would that be? And that's because the waste product of hemp is the inner core, which is called the hemp herd, and it's all cellulose. And DuPont was and still is a munitions maker, and you need cellulose for that. They also had some synthetics, nylon made from cellulose, rayon made from cellulose, cellophane made from cellulose. They also made an additive for gasoline called tetraethyl lead, they were concerned about hemp ethanol. They also made the sulfides that were necessary to make paper both out of hemp and out of wood pulp, but you need four times as much to make it out of wood pulp. And lastly, they were the biggest shareholder in General Motors, and Ford at the time had a prototype car whose skin was made out of an acrylic embedded with hemp that ran on hemp ethanol. In fact, Ford had long thought that vehicles should run on ethanol, not on gasoline, and hemp ethanol in particular. So DuPont had a strong economic motive, and I think that to a certain extent they were likely just the spokespeople for the petrochemical industry. The law, the Marijuana Tax Act law, was carried by a congressman from North Carolina named Daughton, who frequently carried legislation for DuPont. And another thing that suggests that this had nothing to do with marijuana and everything to do with hemp is that the American Medical Association testified against the Marijuana Tax Act in 1937, and furthermore said that they had never been contacted in the 2 years, and they characterized the development of the Marijuana Tax Act as being developed in secret. And the guy who was testifying for the AMA was very sophisticated. He was the lead counsel for the AMA, a doctor and an attorney, past president of the American Public Health Association, had been the commissioner of health for Washington, D.C. for many years, and after that for Boston, had been involved in developing most federal legislation dealing with drug problems and drug regulation. And he said, not once in the last 2 years have you contacted the AMA.
That's David Behrman, MD, one of the most clinically knowledgeable physicians in America in the field of medicinal marijuana. The interview was conducted by Carol Marks. Coming up next, a discussion about colorectal cancer. March is Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month. When A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues.
July 25th, 2006, we adopted April. She's a purebred, orange and white, Brittany. But when she started scratching like crazy, I said to John, it's got to be her food. You know, what you put into a dog is what you get out. We heard this radio commercial, and this woman was so excited about Dinovite.
DINOVITE.com.
859-428-1000.
I said to John, I'm getting this. So the Dinovite comes, and I thought, a light bulb moment. She loves her dog food. She always leaves a little bit in her bowl. So we have a huge scoop of Dinovite in it, and then we swished it around like gravy. She dove into that bowl. She licked it clean. She loved it. So that's been the routine for almost 10 years. April gets Dinovite for dessert. Her coat is now soft, it's silky, it's smooth. She even walks like a little princess.
859-428-1000.
On Dinovite, she's Little Miss Hollywood.
DINOVITE.com.
Bernadette Duncan spent 26 years as a radio talk show producer. in her new book, Yappy Days, Behind the Scenes with Newsers, Schmoozers, Boozers, and Losers, she shares her adventures in the trenches of big-time talk radio during the changing backdrop of America's pre- and post-9/11 realities. This exciting story includes Bernadette's impressions of the quirky celebrity talk show hosts whom she served during her career, Larry King, Sally Jesse Raphael, Gil Gross, Tom Snyder, Lou Dobbs, Charles Osgood, and more. It's full of anecdotes about hundreds of high-profile guests from media, show business, and politics, also quirky, ego-driven, and neurotic. Yappy Days, Behind the Scenes with Newsers, Schmoozers, Boozers, and Losers, an analytical look at the media, journalism, and the complex nature of ego. Get it now at Amazon.com.
An important message for Americans eligible for Medicare. Are you receiving all the benefits available to you? Do you know there's money available to lower your Medicare prescription cost? Well, now is the time to find coverage that's right for you at the right price. You can spend hours looking for it yourself, or you can call Health Markets and let us do the legwork for you. We'll search a variety of plans from nationally recognized companies to find coverage that's the best fit for you at a price that fits your budget. And we'll do it at no charge to you. Plus, you may be able to save money on prescriptions. Call now, see if you qualify, and put our free service to work for you.
800-990-0334. 800-990-0334. 800-990-0334. That's 800-990-0334.
Health Markets Insurance Agency is the DBA of InSphere Insurance Solutions, Inc., licensed in all 50 states and D.C. Service and product availability varies by state. Agents may be compensated based on your enrollment.
This is Brad Shepard. Whenever you think of Social Security, do you think of survivor's benefits too? You see, Social Security is more than retirement. Social Security makes regular monthly payments to the families of workers who die too. More than 7 million people get survivor's benefits from Social Security, including almost 2 million children. Benefits that pay for food and clothing, medical care, and school benefits you can count on when you're planning your financial future. For more information, go to the SSA website at www.ssa.gov.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair. March is Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month, and we turn now to a conversation between the host of our program, Carol Marks, and Dr. Shahab Madizadeh. Dr. Madizadeh is board-certified in gastroenterology, internal medicine, and nutrition.
Now, we're talking today about colorectal cancer, the second leading cause of death from cancer in the United States, and the third most common cancer overall. In fact, more women over the age of 75 die from colorectal cancer than from breast cancer. So let's just talk briefly about how it starts out as a precancerous polyp, and if it's found, it can be benign or not. But what happens after one does have a colonoscopy and they do find a polyp?
Great question. So that's why we can prevent colon cancer, because it starts from a benign polyp that we can visually see and remove. So during colonoscopy, we basically remove these polyps by various methods, and we remove them completely so that nidus, or the polyp that can later in a few years can become colon cancer, is removed. And that chance of colon cancer from that polyp is essentially removed. And that's why doing early detection and colonoscopy has for years actually decreased the rate of colon cancer.
Now let's talk a little bit about the new study that came out. It talks about the rate of rectal and colon cancer, whether it's growing or falling in different age groups. First, when it comes to adults over 55, I understand the rate has dropped. Do we have any reason why?
Part of the main reason for that drop has been because we've done such a good job with colonoscopies, with the screening for colonoscopy and removing polyps. But as you mentioned, we're now seeing a rather steep rise in the younger Americans getting colon cancers.
And it's amazing because with great information you sent to me, you said, and it grabbed my attention, that people born around 1990 have double the risk of getting colon cancer and quadruple the risk of rectal cancer. So why in the world is that true?
This is amazing. So we're seeing the rate still sort of drop in the older Americans in over 55, but we're seeing this rise in those who are in their 20s and 30s, as you mentioned. We think part of that reason, or probably the main part of that reason, is environmental, because the genetics doesn't seem to explain these, although most young cancers, a lot of young cancers can be hereditary, but in these cases that in this study, these were sporadic. These patients did not have family history. So we think environmental factors such as diet and the rise in obesity are very much directly tied into this increase in colorectal cancer.
Dr. Shahab Madizadeh, in conversation with Carol Marks, he's board certified in gastroenterology, internal medicine, and nutrition. We'll have more conversation about colorectal cancer when A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues.
So when we brought him home, we didn't realize that Bear, the rescue dog, was actually sick. He had very flaky skin. He was dropping a lot of fur, and the vet wanted to do steroid injections, special dog food. Nothing seemed to work. So I've been hearing Dinovite on the radio for years.
DINOVITE.com 859-428-1000.
It never actually crossed my mind to try it until I was just at a dead end. And then it finally sunk in. Oh, you're talking about hair and skin. And all right, I'll try it. Well, it took probably 6 weeks, but after we started using Dinovite, no more flaky skin. He doesn't scratch and itch, and he started to put weight on. It was awesome. He makes us feel like we saved him. Every rescue dog in America deserves Dinovite for 90 days. I wish that we would have started the Dinovite right away. It would have been so much easier.
859-428-1000. DINOVITE.com.
Bernadette Duncan spent 26 years as a radio talk show producer. In her new book, Yappy Days, Behind the Scenes with Newsers, Schmoozers, Boozers, and Losers, she shares her adventures in the trenches of big-time talk radio during the changing backdrop of America's pre- and post-9/11 realities. This exciting story includes Bernadette's impressions of the quirky celebrity talk show hosts whom she served during her career, Larry King, Sally Jesse Raphael, Gil Gross, Tom Snyder, Lou Dobbs, Charles Osgood, and more. It's full of anecdotes about hundreds of high-profile guests from media, show business, and politics, also quirky, ego-driven, and neurotic. Yappy Days, Behind the Scenes with Newsers, Schmoozers, Boozers, and Losers, an analytical look at the media, journalism, and the complex nature of ego. Get it now at Amazon.com.
Do you use the expensive blue or yellow pills to charge your sex life? Are you thinking about it? What if we can promise you the same results for less than $3 a pill? If you're paying $20 a pill for the other pills, you're getting taken to the cleaners. Our pills deliver the exact same results for less than $3. You'll save more than $16 a pill for the same results. And right now, radio callers will get 44 blue or yellow pills for $120 with free discreet shipping. You can save more than $700 off pharmacy prices. Charge your sex life now and save a ton of money. Call now and get your 44 pills and save over $700 and qualify for free shipping. Stop overpaying and call right now.
800-296-1548, 800-296-1548, 800-296-1548. That's 800-296-1548.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair. And now here's the final segment of this hour of our broadcast, a conversation between the host of the show, Carol Marks, and Dr. Shahab Madizadeh, board certified in gastroenterology, about colorectal cancer.
What kind of symptoms might a young person have that are kind of, they're so vague that, you know, I can understand why people perhaps didn't think about that they were having a problem.
That's true. I think symptoms being vague is true, and that poses a problem. And we are seeing these young patients getting diagnosed a little bit later than other patients, and that's partly because we as physicians don't often think of someone with symptoms in their 20s and 30s having colon cancer. And so this diagnosis can get delayed. Symptoms can sometimes be similar to just irritable bowel syndrome if it's cramping pain or terrible constipation, but can also sometimes be blood in the stool that can easily be attributed to, for example, hemorrhoids and be mistaken. So we like to take these symptoms more serious even in the younger individuals.
Now, you also wanted to mention, and I think it's important, that patients are sometimes misdiagnosed with diverticulosis when, in fact, they have colon cancer. So, again, how can that happen?
Oh, that's true. So diverticulitis is an inflammation of these small outpouchings in the colon. And generally, patients can develop pain, and they can even have a CAT scan done. In that situation, you can see an area of inflammation or thickening of the colon on the CAT scan, on the imaging study, and that can be called diverticulitis, but there are certain cases where that thickening is actually a colon cancer rather than diverticulitis. So we like to treat patients with antibiotics, but then we like to go and do a colonoscopy in about 4 weeks after that inflammation, 4 to 6 weeks after that inflammation is quieted down.
And as you said, when we first started our discussion, the most important thing that we want to leave our listeners with is that by detecting colon cancer at a young age, it's so important because it's so survivable when caught early. And can you briefly tell our listeners about the young patient in his 40s who came to see you having ignored his symptoms and what happened? And those kind of cases, I'm sure, really affect you.
They do. You know, we've been noticing this trend in younger patients in clinical practice, and among colleagues, we've been talking about our experiences. So this was amazing to see this study come out and actually validate what we have been noticing in clinic. I recently had the opportunity to care for a young patient around 44 years old who was having pain for about 1 year. He had a few CAT scans done in the emergency room because he went for pain. And basically it was attributed to constipation, but really what was happening is he had a colon mass that was preventing him from going to the bathroom and causing him to have constipation. So, you know, this case took about a year. I saw him as a second opinion. And we quickly did a colonoscopy and discovered it. And fortunate that we found it when we did. This patient hopefully is going to surgery actually this week. But the delay has caused that mass to become bigger and metastasize, and that makes treatment so much harder.
Dr. Shahab Madizadeh in conversation with Carol Marks. And that about does it for this installment of A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. Thank you, Carol Marks, our host and founder. Thank you to Dwayne Doobie Jr., our producer on the front line. Thank you to our affiliates across the country and to all our listeners. And on behalf of the entire Touch of Gray broadcast team, I'm Michael Harrison, inviting you to join us here next week for another installment of A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups.